Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, MARHELM.com to get your discount today. Below Investor, we have the privilege of doing a podcast together. We connected over, I think it was Klendathu Capital, who was a former podcast guest. Awesome guy. I have to get him back on the podcast, but I tweeted out, I think at the end of December, just, hey, who do you want to hear on the podcast for next year? And your name got thrown into the mix. And so, since I like Klendathu, I respect his opinion, I was like, okay, I have to dig into this more. And one thing led to another, and here we are in the first couple weeks of 2024 making it happen. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Thanks, Klendathu, for recommending me.
So who is Philo Investor, and how did you get started?
So I started Philo Investor during COVID lockdowns. Just actually serendipitously when friends were asking me a lot of investment related questions, like, is passive better than active? Should I just buy the S&P and do nothing? Isn't real estate the best? And all these things. So instead of having hour long conversations with every single acquaintance, I thought I have to write something down and explain this to so-and-so person. Actually started in the COVID stock market crash when somebody couldn't understand why I was buying stocks. And I wrote the first letter one late night during lockdowns. And then I wrote a few more. And then I got the name of Philo Investor, which is like philosophy, but investor. And I thought I have to buy this domain in case I want it one day. So I bought the domain. I made a WordPress. Then my friend Shrub told me, you know, there's this thing called Substack. You should go on Substack. I said, what's Substack? And that's how it started.
That's awesome. And so what were you doing before COVID that, you know, led you to have, you know, a background in markets, a background in investing and you know, just interest. I know we're going to talk about some stocks all throughout. I mean, you're a generalist investor, so we'll cover everything from kind of energy to tech and all that. But what did you do before you started the website and started writing online more?
Yeah. So I always worked in investments. I never did anything else. I got started as a teenager, actually, during the 1999 stock boom, which wasn't just in the States. It was a global thing. So there was a local stock market mania, and I got intrigued. Why is everybody talking about this? Why are my parents talking about this? What's going on? And, you know, the whole boom-bust situation. I got intrigued by the dynamics of the stock market, the social phenomena. And I started reading slowly, slowly. Then I wanted to study something related to markets. And I got my first job working in investment management after university, always with the ultimate vision to launch my own firm. So I worked many years in my own research analysis, specific companies, macroeconomics, everything basically. And you know, after years, you conclude to an investing framework, your own ways. You learn from everybody. I consider myself self-taught because I never worked under a mentor, to be honest, but I learned from everybody globally. And then you find your own way and you go with it.
So what would you say is your investment framework today as it stands?
Mm-hmm. So I would consider myself to be a value-oriented investor with a business owner mindset. I think value investing has been confused, has a bad rep. So that's why I say business owner. When I say value oriented, I don't mean I look for the, you know, lowest PE and lowest price to book and all those things. When I say value oriented, I mean the typical Warren Buffett way, actually, you know, the cheapest price to intrinsic value. And how do you get to that intrinsic value? You have to know the business intimately, the sector, how it works, and how you expect it to be in 5 and 10 years. That's how you start to get a rough approximation of intrinsic value. And then you look at the price today and you assess where you are. Is it cheap? Is it fair? Is it overvalued? And you make decisions according to that.
Got it. And so you entered 2020, we're in COVID, and people are asking you a bunch of these questions. You said, you know, hey, I'm buying stocks here. What were you buying? Were you buying just the index, or were you buying companies that had been on your radar for a while and you just kind of took the plunge and said, you know, hey, I'm either going to make a lot of money or things are going to get really bad. And then at that point, it doesn't matter what the price of my stocks are.
Yeah, I never buy the index. I like to focus on individual stocks. So at that time, I mean, opportunities were everywhere. I bought some banks in Europe, which I knew were very well, and I knew they would be safe from any COVID lockdowns, tourism problems, travel bans, and all that. I bought some retail stocks, which were really cheap. I bought some industrials. I bought some tech. This was 2020. Then they bounced. I started selling off some of them and kept some others. It was a general, you know, I'm agnostic to sector, geography. Mm-hmm. I want to remain opportunistic.
And so when you have a bunch of ideas that are, let's say, generally equally attractive, something like a COVID where, let's say you've got a watch list of 10 to 15, all these stocks get crushed and all of a sudden you have maybe 5 or 10 names that all look attractive. How do you rank and decide which ones to invest in, if that makes sense?
Yeah. I think considering this, let's say, philosophical question, you have to go for risk reward.
Yeah.
Which is the most robust from all these? Because if one of the five has less risk, or let's say half the risk than the others, then all of a sudden your risk reward doubles, right? So that's a simple heuristic of going about it, especially in a stressful time like COVID, geopolitical conflicts, and all these issues.
And I guess that's just, again, the importance of focusing on the downside. Because one of the things that I realized looking back in I guess kind of the tail end of 2020 when the COVID rip started happening, 2020, 2021, a lot of people seemed just to forget about the downside. And then the risk reward was all based on the leverage to the upside that you could get. And so it didn't matter if a stock's downside was 70%, as long as its upside was 300-400% higher, then that would be okay. But and I fell into that trap as well. But it seemed to have a healthy change of course.
Absolutely, that's what happened. I think almost everyone got caught with that, because when markets become euphoric, it becomes a mania. It's very hard, even for the most disciplined investor, to stay out of the party. But you know, markets give you clues when you want to listen to them. So when you listen to what markets are telling you, for example, post-COVID, when things started to turn, many of these names were not only expensive, but they didn't even have a business.
Yeah.
And I think in this new age, new tech era of markets, anybody can start up a business, raise some money because of the VCs distorting everything, and then they IPO. And many of them have no chance of ever having a business, which is sad, and people have to be very careful.
You've written before about the idea of old versus new business models. And I think the quote unquote new business models that sprung up in a, you know, zero interest rate environment, you're starting to see now that they just can't sustain in a 5-7% interest world. So how do you view this kind of old versus new business model? You could even go old versus new economy when judging investment opportunities.
So when I say old economy stocks or old business model, consider the typical linear businesses, energy, banks, retail, you know, the business of the previous century. It's easy to assess them. It's easy to read their financials. There's nothing crazy about them, like an Apple or a Microsoft or a fintech, let's say, that the business can transform with massive operating leverage and seemingly almost 100% gross margins and all these dynamics, let's say a SaaS business. So it's important for investors to learn to differentiate between business models. You will not read the financials of a bank or a typical retailer the same way you will read the financials of an educational tech company like Coursera or a marketplace like Amazon or Wayfair. I see almost everyone falling into this trap, and they defer to the notion that when interest rates change or when the environment changes, they are all a zero. I think it's important to differentiate between the ones that have a business and the ones that don't. And if they are in your circle of competence, then you could actually find something really interesting there.
So I think an important distinction as we discuss like these old versus new business models is realizing if a business model works, even if they're losing money today, right? Because that could be, they could choose to lose money because they're investing, whether it's through sales and marketing, research and development. And so they'll show operating losses, but you can back into something like, okay, like this business model works if this kind of normalizes. So let's take the Coursera example, because I remember like when they IPO'd, I dug a little bit into them and then I passed because I'm like, there are so many things out there like that. Like, and again, like I know nothing about really the space, but like in my head, I'm like, there's Udemy, there's Coursera, there's YouTube, which is free. And there's, you know, Harvard, MIT online classes. And so how did you view something like a Coursera with this quote unquote kind of new business model and then integrate all of, you know, kind of the competitive challenges in that space?
So firstly, an old economy business would typically run their investment operation or their CapEx through the balance sheet. And the new age would run it through the income statement. because R&D and all this tech expense for a Coursera is typically expense through the income statement. So this skews the bottom line unfairly vis-a-vis an old economy business, number one. For Coursera, how I went about it, I did a research of the whole ecosystem, the company, the whole business model, and I said, you know, this company has a chance of growing by so and so and make X margins or a range of X margins. And if this happens, it's worth this much more. And that was it after doing all the work. For the competition, Udemy is a good competitor, but Coursera views them as part of the space and they're happy to grow with them. They're happy to grow with the space. One of the important aspects of Coursera that I liked was the big ecosystem. So they've been around for a long time. So when they IPO'd, I think they had 80 or 90 million learners, registered learners in their ecosystem. It's 125 now. So it's growing every quarter. They have offerings for corporates as well, big institutions, big companies, universities, governments. So it's diversified. It's not just the $10 you spend to do a course. They have courses from a 30-minute course to a full master's program. And it's early days for them. They have a very strong balance sheet, no debt, 600 million cash or so. It's enough runway to be able to ramp up the business and start to show your stuff.
And so when you think about, you know, again, going back and researching this stock, doing the due diligence, when you talked to, maybe you talked to like bears or skeptics on the name, when you brought up competition, what would they say? Like if you said, oh, I think everyone's just going to grow with the space, I don't think the competition is as severe. If they disagreed, what would they say were the reasons?
Good question. Actually, a very good investor said it's worth nothing because all content will be free.
Yes. Yeah.
And I disagree with that. I don't think content will be free. I think content has a cost. Distribution of content has a cost. The profits from creating and distributing and selling content in the future will also come from these sort of network effects. For example, you mentioned YouTube. YouTube is what it is because they bought it for, I think, $1 billion. It was the only type of ecosystem at the time, and then they just helped it grow and explode. But YouTube is what it is because of the network effect. You will produce and you will post on YouTube because I am there to consume your content. So no way is content free and no way are economics of content zero.
And so another name in this space that I find interesting, just because of actually the memes that you can see from this company, is Duolingo. And I recently bought Rosetta Stone. They had a lifetime membership for $198. So I'm learning Russian. That's my New Year's resolution. And so it was $198 and it was between Rosetta Stone and kind of Duolingo. I chose Rosetta Stone, but then it made me look at the Duolingo stock and it's up significantly since 2023. It's up over 200%. So they're doing something right. The market's liking them. Yeah. You have researched them. You know the business well. Walk me through the Duolingo thesis. Like, what am I missing?
Yeah. So Duolingo is a typical example of a new economy business model that people don't want to understand. High R&D, marketing, all these costs, a very big ecosystem of free learners, and a small percentage of actually paid users. So a bear would say the free product is so good, nobody's going to pay for it. That's number one. Number two, they're never going to make money. Number three, it should be five times cheaper.
Yeah.
So how I went about my Duolingo thesis, basically, in my piece on Philo Investor was similar to Coursera. What can this business do? How big is the runway? What complementary services can they launch and start and start to sell to their big ecosystem? And how much can terminal margins be? That was the big picture. I think it's up three times since then.
Yeah. So what was your estimate for kind of long-term margins, market share growth? Like, let's peel back the layer a little bit and dive deeper into kind of that piece that you wrote.
So Duolingo not only offers courses to learn any language, and by the way, I learned French using it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. They have the Duolingo English test, which people had to take from other associations and places up to now and pay a fee. Let's say somebody that wants to work in the States from South America or Asia, they have to take the Duolingo English test or go to university. I think it's $49 now. And they make money from that too. They make money from the annual subscription for Duolingo Plus, which is the paid version of Duolingo. And they are going to launch a maths product as well to make more sales. So I think margins can be, you know, theoretically, after a point, almost 100%. That's where they tend to for a SaaS type product, I think.
Yeah.
When you don't need marketing, when your R&D is more or less covered by a very big revenue base, your margins are just crazy.
Yeah.
So it's these dynamics that changes the economics of these businesses and makes it hard for people to understand how much money they can make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something that I get and that makes sense to me. I think if I were to play devil's advocate with myself, it would be questioning at what time and at what significance does that sales and marketing spend reduce so that it flows to the bottom line? Because on the one hand, the argument is you build up this marketplace, you get large enough, the flywheel effects take over, and now you've got word of mouth, zero cost advertising, and so you can peel it back. But on the other hand, as we mentioned, like with the internet and things like Coursera, like the distribution of content, like the cost to distribute is low and there's tons of free options. And so on the other hand, I'm thinking, will this SG&A spend ever come down? Because will they ever be in a position to not have to be in front of the customer 24/7 to remind them, if that makes sense? Because depending on those levers and when you decide to pull them, that could mean the world in terms of cash flow, operating profits, and then the multiple that you assign to that company.
Absolutely. It's a very big aspect of the ultimate valuation of a company. But I think that's where DCFs and all these spreadsheet type analysis fail.
Okay.
I've never really liked them. I did start off with them, obviously, but then I just did my own thing. I think after you learn a business and its ecosystem and understand how the numbers can look like, you have to do a back of the envelope ultimately. I like to do that with Philo Investor just to give people a broad understanding of what a business can do and how I look about it. So you don't know where sales and marketing will drop, lower R&D. These things are evolving. But what you can do is turn the question on its head and say, what price am I willing to pay for this potential upside and uncertainty today? So you can always value them as options. You can say, if it fails, I won't lose money or I will lose half in a given time period. But if this and this happens, I can make 5x or 50x, which is a completely different way of looking at it compared to the classical value investing, right?
And when you look at Duolingo to do the back of the envelope, is that just breaking it down into maybe like a per learner basis or a per, you know, kind of student basis where you say, okay, in 5 years, round numbers, random numbers, they're going to have 100 million users. Each user generates X amount of revenue and then assume 15, 20% margins. This is how much profit they'll make per user. And this is how much they'll make as a company. And then that's how you kind of get that envelope math, basically.
For Duolingo, what I would do is something like that. Yeah, I would say in a given time period, they can have 10X more learners. And of all these learners, the paid percentage will not be 3 or 4%. It will be, say, 10. And costs will be lower percentage-wise because of operating leverage and business maturity. And so margins will be at this range. Therefore, it can make between so much and so much. Mm-hmm. And you slap a multiple on that and you get a range valuation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is what I did with Netflix as well.
Yeah. And that's we can dive right into Netflix because I was looking, I think it was on Twitter, and I saw something about Amazon Prime with their video streaming. They were offering basically a higher charge for Prime with no ads, but then their regular Prime, I think, is just basically streaming with ads. So TV, like what we had with cable. And now there was a bunch of, you know, memes about it where the streaming packages between Prime, Netflix, Hulu, Peacock, I mean, you name it, like all of those combined is now worth significantly more than whatever the cable bill would be per month. And so walk me through this legacy media versus this streaming business. We can do it through the lens of Netflix. We can start from the top down, but it's looking like streaming is becoming as expensive, if not more, than legacy media was.
Mm-hmm. So legacy media I define as the old media companies, Disney, Paramount, Warner Brothers, the studios, let's say, okay? Yeah. And then basically because of technological improvement, Netflix comes around with a streaming-only offering. They don't have linear TV. They don't have cable TVs. They don't have studios. They just start with a streaming-only product after their whole DVD, obviously. Mm-hmm. Legacy media was being cynical about them. They never thought they could do something. They never thought they had the content. But Netflix chose a different path to growth. They cast a very wide net. They went global from the beginning. Slowly, slowly, they ramped up their global distribution capabilities. And then they started bringing in their own content, either by licensing deals. I think it was Friends, the first one. And then by actually spending money to create their own content. And this original content, exclusive content strategy, brought in people that were willing to pay a very small fee to have Netflix each month. And slowly, slowly, that ecosystem grew and the internet grew and cord cutting became worse and worse because people wanted to be more mobile. They wanted to watch things on their laptops or their phones or here and there. And at some point, there was a reckoning where legacy media was failing with very big debt loads, with failing studios and content and franchises, with linear TV dropping, so the revenues were also dropping from ads and from fees from the cable operators. So they decided we have to get into streaming too, and we're going to become the Netflix killers. They were saying they're going to become the Netflix killers. So they made a huge pivot towards streaming. They started to spend a lot of money to create new content, to develop their infrastructure, and move to streaming. But the reason why I stress that Netflix is streaming only and streaming first is because legacy media is having a very hard time bridging the gap from linear and legacy offerings and distribution deals to direct to consumer. And I believe ultimately they will fail, because they are very slow to adapt. They have a lot of debt. They are tied to the hip with their linear TV businesses, which is actually where the money comes from and is keeping them afloat. And all this confusion and lack of strategy is, I believe, going to kill this whole sector. I think in 10 years, this case study will be taught in business universities, business schools.
So do you think basically given the cost structure and given the bloat that still exists in legacy media, that there's room for these streaming-only companies to look and feel more like cable companies, but still command and kind of hold their market share while legacy media tries to move where the streaming is, and they just can't. And so the streaming companies take the economics because they're pricing and moving and looking more like legacy without legacy impeding on their ability to do that.
Well, actually, I think it's already over because of two reasons. Number one, Disney was forced to throw in the towel with the Charter deal recently, mm-hmm. where Charter said, you know, if you don't continue with our way and our requirements in this deal, there's no deal. We don't really care about offering content to our subscribers because we don't make money from that. We only make money from it, the internet cable, rather than TV offerings. Mm-hmm. So we don't care about video. And Disney had to go with Charter's demands, because if they didn't, they would lose a lot of ESPN revenue, a lot of linear TV revenue suddenly, and it would be over for Disney. Mm-hmm. It would slowly start to be over. So Disney conceded to Charter's demands, and they also conceded to offering a version of Disney Plus to Charter subscribers of a certain package, which means that calling it DTC is a lie, is an oxymoron, because you're still going through distribution. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, big legacy media companies have already started to slowly get into distribution deals with a streamer like Netflix. So they went from Netflix killer to kind of killing their own self into an existential crisis, and then start to understand that they need to use other people's ecosystems to distribute the content, else the economics don't work at all. So this is a big picture.
Yeah.
They also have a lot of debt. They have complicated relationships and interconnectedness. For example, Disney has the parks. They make money. Linear TV makes money. DTC is loss-making to maybe break even.
Yeah, and I remember seeing something about Peacock losing millions and millions a year, NBC's offering. But you mentioned Disney Plus, which I forgot about because I think that's the one we don't pay for. But how do you view Disney? It's an extremely polarizing company, and we can even get into the philosophical reasons why Disney is very polarizing. But you look at this legacy, you could call them a legacy media, legacy IP business, and extremely hated for both cultural and, I guess, fundamental reasons. Now, I think if you look at the stock chart over the last 5-something years, maybe it's returned 0% or something like that. I could be wrong, but it feels like it's flatlined over 5 years. How do you view Disney as a business, as a potential investment? Like, are you just wouldn't touch it, or what are your thoughts?
The reason why I wrote the whole media thematic series on Philo Investor is because I think investors have to understand the difference between investing in a company and owning certain assets that a company has. For example, everybody was saying, you know, Disney has a great library of content and they have the best content of the past 100 years and they have so and so. Sure, but if they can't monetize that and they're burning much more money elsewhere, they will go out of business. It doesn't matter if they own Mickey Mouse. If Disney goes bankrupt, somebody else will own Mickey Mouse after them. So the assets a company owns is different than the company itself. It's the same with offshore drillers. You know, people focus on what kind of offshore drillers Transocean owns rather than the whole business. It's important not to conflate. For me, Disney is completely uninvestable for the things I previously said. And also because I think management and Bob Iger have no strategy, have a big ego, are rich and happy, and they're not willing to do what it takes proactively rather than reactively to not only save this business, but adapt it into a changing world.
And it's hard too, because Disney's one of those companies where some would consider them like a coffee can name, where you buy Disney, you put it in a coffee can, and you never look back. And in 20, 30 years, you'll be happy with your return. And I think it's hard for investors to stomach the fact that that might not be true, because it's been true for so long. And you mentioned their IP, and you wonder how quickly a company can destroy the value of their IP. It's like, I forget who said the quote, but it's, you know, it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and one day to ruin it. And you wonder if that's what Disney's doing, and if that's what's playing out on the you know, grand scheme, where it's just, they took 100 years to develop this Disney brand and the Disney IP, and maybe it takes just a few years for it to become a fraction of what it's worth.
Great point. So I've previously said that the world is becoming more and more fat-tailed. What do I mean by this? Globalization, the internet, all these dynamics change the world and make it more interconnected, and things can happen much faster. So things that were previously understood as fat tails and outliers are becoming more common now and even more pronounced. So absolutely, I believe Disney can kill itself in a 5-year time span.
What other fat tails do you see throughout the world? It doesn't have to be investing related, but just using this theme of, you know, the world's becoming more fat tail oriented. What are some other examples?
I think social trends and the fiscal situations of countries. I can elaborate.
Yeah, please do, because I was going to ask what does that mean?
Yeah. So if you see the balance sheets of, let's say, the major Western economies, US, the European bloc, and Japan, we are over indebted. We are running deeply into budget deficits. Our politics is confused. It's short-termistic. It's self-privileged and self-entitled. There is no serious plan to get our books in order. Nobody talks about that. All they talk about is, you know, a politician that wants to be elected talks about what they will give us and what they will offer us and how they will change things. But it's like Groundhog Day, nothing really happens. And every year we owe more and more money. And somebody who disagrees with me may say that, you know, we have our central banks and we're printing money and we have all these economics, but ultimately, when you take economics to first principles, we are just, it's the same thing, we're bankrupting ourselves. And this is why inflation spiked, this is why there's a cost of living crisis in certain areas, because the state is not using our tax revenues correctly. And further geopolitical conflict will make this even worse.
I tweeted earlier this week about just the relative cheapness in emerging markets versus the US. And a lot of people said, hey, the way to play this is China, which I disagree. I think I like Latin America personally, and Poland. Can't forget about Poland. How do you view the emerging market investability landscape versus the US? And like, if you look out over the next 3 to 5 years, you've got interesting situations playing out in Latin America. If it's higher inflation, commodity countries tend to do a little bit better. If that's, you know, Brazil and a lot of Latin America. Yeah. Argentina has a new anarcho-capitalist president shaking things up. Like, in a world of fat tails, how does emerging markets play into it?
First, I think it's important to take it on a case-by-case basis. Not all companies in China or Brazil are obviously the same. That's number one. And number two, even with very high inflation, a good business, a high quality business will make it and also create value. For example, the Coca-Cola bottlers of South America, or an emerging market that has trouble. If you choose the good business and it's robust enough, has a good enough balance sheet and management, knows what it's doing, you will do well. But I think the reason why the US is doing so much better performance-wise compared to, say, Europe or some good emerging markets is because of the whole passive investing theme. Mm-hmm. All the flows are going to these big companies, which happen to be in the States, but they're global, right? The Apples of the world. And they just benefit from passive flows, which are value indiscriminate. They don't care about the value. And their prices benefit from this. So that's one layer. Intrinsic value-wise, yes, I believe you can find great businesses all over the world. Actually, I was invested in a retailer in Greece during the 2015 saga with Europe, when Europe threatened the Grexit, you know, you're going back to the Greek drachma and all that. I remember this situation. I said to myself, you know, this business is so good. I don't care if it goes to the drachma. I know it can make money even in that scenario. It didn't go to the drachma, but just an example.
So what was the business? This is interesting.
This was Jumbo. It's a retailer from Greece with stores in other countries as well. Sells toys and seasonal products and home and stationery and things like that in very big stores. It has great margins, great bottom line, a great owner operator, a fortress balance sheet. So its price obviously dropped by a lot during that situation. So it was an opportunity. It's 5 times since the bottom of the 2015 situation without considering very rich dividends.
So how'd you find that name? Was it just you knew the, you know, Grecian stock market, or how'd you find it?
I just knew the business from real life. And I said, oh, wow, what does this business look like? I remember I couldn't believe how much money they were making.
So what would you compare the store to, like the US equivalent? Is it more of a Five Below? Is it more of a Walmart? What's the comparable?
It's like a Poundland, which is a UK thing.
Okay.
There's a lot of cheap things, but not only cheap things. Anything from inflatable beds for the sea to, you know, inflatable toys, seasonal stuff, stationery, things for Christmas and the carnival.
Okay. Sounds like a Five Below-ish. Yeah. Which is a fantastic, I mean, Five Below is a fantastic company.
Yeah, they own the whole space, this company, Jumbo.
So when you look out and you try to find new ideas for whether it's research, investing, or both, how do you determine where to go? Is it you look in places that are most bombed out? You look at, you know, countries or industries that are making new highs? What's the process?
Yeah, I don't go to places which are more bombed out anymore. I maybe used to do that 15 years ago, but I realized it's not the best way to find the most value. And actually the way I go about it, I learned about it from David Einhorn, who says that what do we seem to understand about a certain security that the market seems to be missing? So the company could be 52-week lows or 52-week highs. It could be the biggest business in the world. It doesn't matter. So approaching investing with this way saves you from a lot of traps. And I found it very beneficial. I could use a product or service in my own life. I could hear about it from somebody else. Maybe the sector is going through some change at the moment. Could be positive, could be negative. Just some sort of potential confusion or misconception, which gives you the opportunity to find value.
You mentioned something interesting where you said you used to look at, you know, new lows or look at places that were bombed out, and now you don't. Now you maybe venture towards new highs. And I think that runs counter to what a lot of value-oriented investors would think. And so why did you make that change? And then what's the kind of deeper reason behind that? Is it just success begets success, or is it something more?
Success does beget success in many instances. That's one. But you know the Warren Buffett quote, which says, don't look at the price before you research a company. It's kind of like that. So I ignore price and I don't obsess over it until the time comes to make the decision to invest or not. I don't care whether it's at lows or highs. Maybe it's at all-time highs and something is changing, or they're getting, the new obesity drug, like say Novo Nordisk, the Danish company. It's been going up for forever. Somebody could say 10 years ago, I'm not going to buy it. It's an all-time high, and they miss out on I don't know how many X's. So you don't want to handicap your brain into making the right decision.
One of my resolutions this year was to actually buy near the lows, buy more near the lows, and buy more on weakness, which goes against it's actually you and I are kind of the reverse. Like I've spent most of my investing career looking at relative strength winners, stocks that are, breaking out, that are moving higher, and then going through that list. But I'm trying to develop that other muscle, which is to look at stuff that's bombed out, because I think there's value in both. But I also agree with what you said, like the hardest time to buy stocks is when they're making new highs. And one of my colleagues at MacroOps, Octavio, he always says this to me because it's hard for me to believe, but he says the best time to buy a stock is when it's making new highs, both on a risk-adjusted basis and an absolute return basis. And it runs so counterintuitive to the value investing approach of buying a bargain and buying at a lower price that it's hard to wrap my brain around.
It's important to differentiate between investing and trading. When you want to invest in a company, you go about it a completely different way. Trading, on the other hand, is the exact opposite. Investing is only fundamental considerations, and trading is non-fundamental considerations. So when you said you want to buy on weakness, what do you mean? Price weakness on trading to maybe average down, or when a company is going through a problem like Meta a couple of years ago? I think Warren Buffett does both. He wants to find the best companies and he waits for an opportune time. That's what makes the great return.
And I think that's really where I was going with that, with the weakness is just usually when you're buying strength and when you're buying something that's making new highs, like things are working in the stock. There aren't any issues. Relatively speaking, but when you look at stuff that's making new lows or bouncing off all-time lows, like there are clear and identifiable problems and reasons why they are that low. And I like that idea because then it forces me to use these muscles of, okay, is this problem temporary or is it structural? Is it a yes or is it a no? Should I dig further? And I think it's helping me become just a more complete investor, where I'm trying to identify structural versus temporal problems and seeing if those things can be easily fixed by management or some kind of easy change that they can pull.
And also distinguish in which part of its life cycle is the business in. For example, Apple is not early stage by any means. It's the most successful company in capitalism and it's at highs now. Would you buy it here? Because it's at $200. If it's late stage business and dropping like an IBM, then it has problems. If it's an earlier stage company which went through a short-term issue, and it's at the lows, that could mean massive opportunity. So, each case is different for sure.
I think that's a great point because I watched the Apple documentary, not a documentary, but it was like a docu-movie, I think, with Michael Fassbender. And at one point they showed like the stock chart of Apple in its early history. Like you would have sold 100 different times throughout that early stage, but it was so early in the game where you could look at something like a new lows list at an Apple and say, okay, this is an early stage company. They're growing, they're hitting some issues. Do I think this is temporal? Do I think this is structural? And at that life cycle, like you said, that point in the life cycle, that's a completely different question based on where the stock is trading than now where it's, you know, almost a $1 trillion company or something like that, you know, trying to stretch its end markets as far as possible.
Absolutely. I bought Apple 10 years ago, December 2013. I did the whole research of the ecosystem and the company and all the Chinese smartphones and all the competition, all those things. And I bought with both hands, but nobody wanted to listen to me. Nobody cared. Now everybody knows that Apple is the obvious winning company.
Yeah.
You would sell 100 times for sure. If you have a long-term thesis, though, for example, the Carl Icahn story pains me because Carl Icahn could have made maybe $10, $15 billion more if he stayed with Apple. But he sold Apple 10 years ago. It was mid-2014, when the States had issues with China. So his idea was, I can't hold this. Because if we have problems with China, Apple is going to lose a lot of revenue and I need to sell. They had a huge position, humongous position. If Carl Icahn said, look, even if we take some pain in China, this is a beast. We're going to make money from every other geography and it's enough. But he didn't. So these are the, you know, mistakes. If you have a long-term thesis and you know where a company's going, you can make an absolute killing. On that note, one more point. Even Reed Hastings of Netflix didn't keep most of his shares as Netflix was going up because he didn't believe. He didn't know. If he stayed on, he would possibly be one of the richest people today.
That's crazy. Steve Ballmer is richer than Bill Gates because exactly because he held his Microsoft stock.
Is he richer? Is he richer?
I want to say I saw something. Let me see.
Wow.
Ballmer Gates. I want to say I saw something like that. So this is Steve Ballmer, fifth richest person in the world. So as of last year, he was one spot behind Gates. Which still, if you think about it, is just insane.
Crazy.
And that's because he just never sold his Microsoft stock.
Not because I think, you know, Bill was divesting and diversifying, and Microsoft went sideways for 10 years and then just exploded. Mm-hmm. Did a 10x, I think. I don't know, something crazy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, you can make a lot of money if you think as a business owner, but you have to take pain.
Yeah. Part of your name, obviously, there's the Philo investor. We've discussed a lot of the philo, or we've discussed a lot of the investor part. There's still the philosophy part. Yeah. When you look at investors writ large today, where do you think their greatest weaknesses are philosophically? And it could be just their approach to markets. It could be their approach to the mental side of investing. Where do you think the biggest issues are, biggest rooms for improvement?
Individual investors?
Yep.
Their biggest weaknesses? I think investors have a lot of biases about sectors they haven't looked into or businesses they haven't looked into. I think it's easy to fall into the trap that price is truth. You know, when things are dropping, I'm being corroborated, my thesis is corroborated, or the opposite. But actually, the way markets work, it could be any of the two. I think we obsess about short-term performance too much. And this is even more for people who aren't trading their personal accounts that are actually working for other people. The pressure to perform, that time horizons are getting more and more compressed over time. So short-termism wins along. I think there's a big part of investors that are looking for lottery tickets, and they're trying to cling off big themes like, you know, gold to 10,000 or oil to 500 or something seemingly crazy, and they try to buy the most leverage security to that price, like a bankrupt junior miner or something like that. So that's not a business oriented mindset. That's just basically gambling with no advantage or no edge.
Yeah.
I think people haven't received the correct education to think as an investor. That's why I wrote more than 20 education and mindset pieces on Fila Investor. And ultimately, being an investor is like being an athlete. I mean, you will get punched all over. It will hurt. You will lose sleep. You will get muscle soreness because of all the work. It's a full-time job. So maybe people aren't actually cut out or ready for what is to come. It's very hard for people to hold on to their portfolio when things are dropping, even if they use those products every day. The market has a big power. So I think it's a holistic thing.
I think a lot of investors aren't prepared for 5 to 10 years of sideways and 5 to 10 years of just nothing. And you mentioned this with Microsoft, where Microsoft for 5 or 10 years went nowhere. And Tesla had the same sort of thing. Tesla for 5 years went nowhere. And, you know, obviously before these things broke out, but you wonder with the short-termism that is just rampant through markets, like what that would do to an investor's psyche, where I think a lot of investors are just programmed that, oh, the market goes up 7-8% a year, like clockwork. So my portfolio will go up 7-8% a year. But if we get a few years with higher inflation and a portfolio that goes nowhere, like that will be very challenging for a lot of people because it'll be very different for a lot of people.
If you ask a random guy from the streets, what do you want from your investment? He would say, I just want to make something every year. That could be rent. It could be dividend. It could be annuity. People just don't think like business owners. They're not about creating value. They want to generate cash and solve their problems, which is fine because people have problems. That's how it is. But, you know, people forget that one investment in your portfolio could do 100x or even 1000x if you give it long enough time. Mm-hmm. And that could change your life. This is a big thing. This is a big theme. People prefer fixed income, you know, real estate, dividend paying stocks. But a dividend paying stock doesn't mean it's going to pay you a dividend forever. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said earlier, I don't care if it's a new highs or new lows. I just care about longevity and value. And that's kind of my beef with mega cap stocks right now. It's kind of like 1999 in a different dynamic. Mm-hmm. And people say, I want to buy the S&P, I want to buy the NASDAQ, but it could go sideways for 15 years. I think it will at some point. I think it will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have no idea when, but yeah, it's just something to think about. And you mentioned, you know, hey, it takes one winner to kind of, you know, change the course of your investing life. And my favorite quote from the Market Wizards books, I think it was the first one. I think it was Michael Marcus talking about Bruce Kovner, or it was the other way around. But basically, one of them said, you know, the most influential moment for me was when I realized that it's possible to make $1 million in the market. And it's wild. Just when you actually believe something to your core and you believe something is possible, what that can do to your psyche and what that can do. Because like take Michael Marcus, he was blowing up account after account after account. And I know that he's more of a trader, but same sort of thing. Like he was blowing up account after account, and maybe you're a long-term investor and you keep getting these ideas wrong and they're not working. But once he realized like, hey, it's possible, I can do it. Like I have seen other people make $1 million in the market. You know, that sort of positivity can go a long way.
I remember the quote from the book, and that's absolutely how it is. It's all about risk reward. End of the day, it's all risk reward, trading, investing. But people aren't wired like that. That's why it's hard to be a trader and tough to be an investor. And that's why a good trader went through 5 or 10 years of training and suffering to become the person who is wired like that, take losses, drawdowns, go sideways, wait, not make money until you bag that whale, depending on what your strategy is. I mean, you could be a Marcus Spitznagel, you could be a Michael Marcus, a Soros, a Buffett, doesn't matter. You own your strategy. You are your own edge.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I think that's a great place to end, is you own your strategy, you own your edge, and your strategy and edge is going to be different than someone else because it's unique to you and it fits your personality and your risk tolerance. And I think that's a great reminder, and I think that's a great way to end. So, you know, Philo, thanks so much for coming on the show. I have two more questions for you that I ask every guest. The first one is, where can people go to find more about you? If they liked what they heard and they want to read more of your content, follow you on Twitter/X, where can they go?
So my name on Twitter is Philo Investor, like philosophy, but investor, and also philoinvestor.com is my Substack, a lot of content. You'll find everything there. My social media, my emails.
They're all everything. On there.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then the last question I have, if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Oh, wow. Are we talking investing focused or?
It could be literally anything.
Leonardo da Vinci.
I don't know if that person has been chosen. So why? Besides, like, the obvious, it's Da Vinci. Like, that'd be insane.
Why? Because he was an outsider. He was a kind of an outcast from his family because of the way he was born and all those dynamics. And he was self-taught in almost all these disciplines. And he created things from nothing. Changed the world with his writings and creations and influence.
Yeah. That would be a fantastic conversation. I would love to get his opinion on, like, the modern art in air quotes that you see, where it's just like a bunch of scribbles on a page.
That would be funny.
Just to show him that and be like, this is art. This is what we call art today. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah.
We'd probably roll around. Awesome. Well, Philo, thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate
it. Thanks, Brandon.
I'm glad we got to get it done. Thank you, Clindothu Capital, for the recommendation. And I hope, you know, best of success for you this year. I enjoy your writing. I enjoy your content. And I hope more people can read and follow you as a result of this podcast.
Thank you so much. Likewise, best of luck for the year. And let's do this again.